Before we start the podcast today, we wanted to recommend a brand new podcast called Very Bad Words. It's about, well, very bad words. Put together by our friend Matt Fidler. Go check it out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Nina Porzuki here with
Patrick Cox. This is The World in Words.
So Patrick, working on language stories over the past couple of years, there's this line that I always tread with hesitation, and I'm wondering if you tread the same thing.
Ooh, let me guess. Pronunciation?
Yes, I tread that line, but no. Another line, think. Making the distinction between language and dialect.
Oh, yeah.
So I am constantly ticking people off. A few podcasts ago, for example, we were talking about the Italian writer Elena Ferrante, remember? And the Neapolitan dialect. And very quickly, some of you wrote to exclaim, Neapolitan is not a dialect, it's a language.
Oh, yeah, we had the same thing with Mustang, didn't we? Language/dialect in Nepal.
Yes. So what makes a language? What makes a dialect? I asked a bunch of linguists and language experts. How would you define, for you, just as a linguist, language versus dialect? You hear that sigh? I was met with that sigh again and again.
As a linguist, I will not engage in trying to define language and trying to define dialect.
That's linguist Bojan Belic, and he is definitely not alone.
I don't think any linguist feels like a sense of physics envy because they can't classify, you know, every variety of speech in the world as either a language or a dialect.
Lane Green writes about language for The Economist. Not even a little? Not even a little bit of envy?
A little bit some days. Maybe it depends on the linguist. But I mean, if you look at the color spectrum, red turns into orange by a series of very fine, basically continuous gradations. So at what point does red become orange?
That's a really good way of putting it. At what point does red become orange? When does a dialect become a language?
And what does it even matter? So this week, red, orange.
Reddish orange, orangish red.
And how classifying a language versus a dialect matters. So we could have focused on anywhere in the world, but this week we're going to stay in two regions of Europe, Scandinavia and the Balkans.
Do you know it's like a crime series called The Bridge?
Charlotta Guskins is a linguist at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, though she's originally from Denmark. Danish is her mother tongue. She's a big fan of the Danish-Swedish TV series The Bridge. Now, you might have caught the U.S. adaptation of the show. It took place between the U.S. and Mexico. But she's talking about this Danish-Swedish original series.
A bridge between two worlds.
You know, there's a bridge between Copenhagen and Sweden, so you can drive across the water from Denmark to Sweden.
A bridge between good and evil, and between two cops of two nations.
And in the middle of this bridge, there's this body found. And because it's precisely on the border of Sweden and Denmark.
What looks like a single crime.
The police from Denmark and from Sweden are involved in finding the murderer.
Turns into high-tech serial killings, threatening all of Scandinavia.
So they speak Danish and Swedish during the whole series to each other.
And this delights Charlotta because this is exactly what she studies. No, not murder, but mutual intelligibility.
You must have been excited speaking mutual intelligibility.
Yeah, I use it a lot as an example to show that how it works.
Mutual intelligibility is one factor that many people use to distinguish between a language and a dialect. Except Danish and Swedish and Norwegian are all mutually intelligible languages. Big L.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, most Danes and Swedes and Norwegians, they can understand each other very easily. It's funny you mentioned the bridge because I remember when that bridge opened. I lived in Denmark before the bridge was built, but then I went back just when it opened and did some reporting, I stood on the bridge and did what we in radio call the stand-up, where you know,
right at the spot of the murder.
Stand right there, and it wasn't quite at the spot of the murder. It was on the Danish side, and there were all of these great anecdotes about the differences between Danes and Swedes, how they had approached building the bridge because it was a joint project, and how they communicated while they were building the bridge, which was completely mutually intelligible, but they kind of had some fun with slight different variations on words that they use for various technical terms.
But the word for bridge in Danish and in Swedish, is it the same?
Yes, although the Swedish word for the bridge is bron, and the Danish is bron.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So the Danish has got an extra E and they're pronounced somewhat differently. I actually don't know how the Swedish is pronounced, B-R-O-N, but I just, bron. That's my fake Swedish accent.
They're somewhat similar, though, so you can hear kind of how the two words are somewhat right. Mutually intelligible.
And not dissimilar to English either.
So Swedes, Danes, and Norwegians, according to the economist Lane Green, he says that they call their respective tongues neighbor languages.
They are neighbors. They're close to each other. They have an entwined political history. They were all part of a single union once upon a time. Then they split up. And for most of that time, Norway was part of Denmark. And the language of Norway was essentially Danish spoken in a different way. Sweden went its own way. And then for 100 years, I think, or so, Norway became part of Sweden and then became independent.
And this term neighbor languages makes it all sound so very cozy. Or, and you're going to hate me for this, dare I say, hygge. But it wasn't always so cordial and cozy. As Lane Green pointed out, Denmark and Norway was a political union from the 14th until the 19th century. And the written language of Norway during that time was actually Danish. So then in 1814, we're getting into a little bit of history here, Norway was more or less handed over to the Swedes. And this second union lasted for almost another 100 years until Norway gained independence in 1905. And during that near century of rule under the Swedes, the Norwegians debated how to distinguish their written form from Danish. So there were two camps. Should they go back to written Norwegian, the Old Norse of the 14th century before Danish rule, like so way going way back, or should they just Norwegianize what already existed? And that schism still is playing out in Norway today.
No wonder I never really understood much Norwegian. But despite all of this history and these occupations and all of that, Swedish, Danish and Norwegian, they're all totally recognized as languages, right? Not as dialects.
Exactly. And here's how Lane sees it.
So they have this complicated political situation, but now they're very friendly. And there's lots of travel, lots of people who live in different countries, marry across the lines and so forth. And there's this concept of neighbor languages because it would be odd to call them foreign languages. Written Danish and written Norwegian are so close that they're just, it's just like one slightly spelled differently. Swedish is more different still. The Swedish speech sounds a lot more like Norwegian speech. So sometimes there's a joke that Norwegian is Danish spoken with a Swedish sound system or a Swedish accent. Uh-huh. So that's how close they all are.
What I find really fascinating is without having to worry about distinguishing their languages as different enough to be languages and not dialects, mutual intelligibility becomes, you know, an asset for these neighbor languages. It knits the region together in a sense. You know, politicians in the region, they regularly meet and they speak in their languages with ease. Business people can easily communicate. I've even heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, but of Danes and Norwegians and Swedes becoming life partners and never even having to learn their partner's language.
Yes, that's true. I know of people who, what they get better at is understanding the other's dialect.
The other side.
The other side, but they don't jump over and speak it.
Right. Linguist Charlotta Guskins, she calls this ability to sort of speak across languages receptive multilingualism.
But there's always a linguistic term for these things.
Huh? Exactly.
Receptive multilingualism. That just sounds like lazy bilingualism, right?
I suppose.
Passive-aggressive bilingualism.
So Charlotta, she thinks a lot about how receptive multilingualism works and how you can actually measure mutual intelligibility.
How different should languages be before they are languages?
That's the biggest question. What is mutual intelligibility? What does that even mean?
Yeah, some linguists suggested we can just measure how welcome people understand each other. But of course, it's also a problem because we don't know how well should people be able to understand each other for them to be speaking different or similar languages.
So it almost sounds like she's saying she's not really measuring when orange becomes red, right?
Right. She's saying it's super complicated to figure out when orange becomes red. And then here's another further complication. What happens if the speaker of one language understands the second language speaker better than the speaker of that second language understands the first? Okay, that's complicated. So, for example, Danes often understand Swedes better than Swedes understand Danes. And so there's an asymmetry in understanding. So how does this happen? Why does this happen?
I remember in the time when I was in Denmark, pre-cable TV, we didn't have many choices for watching TV. And to be perfectly frank, in Copenhagen, right next to Sweden, you could get Swedish TV and it was much, much better than Danish TV. So we tended to watch a lot of Swedish TV. So over the years, Danes would have come to understand Swedish just by being familiar with it on TV. Plus, you have the fact that Sweden was just a bigger country, a more important country, and it's, quote, you know, produces cars
IKEA.
And IKEA and all of that stuff. And there's this sense of it being sort of a major player. And Denmark defined itself, for better or worse, as Little Denmark.
So attitude could possibly be one reason Charlotte, she wanted to figure out, like, what was this asymmetry about? And if attitude is possibly part of the phenomenon. But she says,
attitudes is really something very difficult to investigate. The problem with attitude experiments is that it's really important how the speaker sounds. So if you have people listen to some language fragment and you ask, how do you like this language? Do you think it sounds beautiful or ugly? It really matters who pronounced the text that they listen to.
So she found bilingual Danes and Swedes with pleasant voices, right? And she recorded them speaking both languages. Then she played these recordings to other Swedes and Danes. So the Danes and Swedes being tested would hear a bilingual Dane speaking an accentedless Danish. And then that same bilingual Dane speaking Swedish without an accent. So same voice, ruling out any kind of prejudice there.
And it turned out that the Swedes were much more negative to this person when he spoke Danish than when he spoke Swedish, while the Danes were rather positive towards Swedish and also towards their own language. Mostly people are positive towards their own language.
All right, so she found some prejudice, but it's hard from this study kind of to extrapolate why there's prejudice. Like, what about Danish is harder to understand?
Once you've got rid of all of those influences, is it something intrinsic to the language?
Itself.
Like, a lot of people do say that Danish is very difficult to both pronounce and to understand because it's very throaty and, you know. I'm trying to avoid the word ugly, but I'm going to just have to throw it in there. We've done a podcast before about this.
So Charlotte, she thought about this too, and she gave the test to people from Germany and Holland. And turns out they had the exact same results. Negative feelings towards Danish, while generally positive feelings towards Swedish. But then Charlotte thought, you know, German and Dutch people, they might have preconceived notions about Sweden and Denmark. She factored in culture, and she factored in warm and fuzzy feelings for a beloved character from Swedish children's books. Freedom call
and Pippi run. Longstocking, you know, this little
with the red-headed girl, Pippi Longstocking,
and that's really what people hear when they hear Swedish. They think of her, and they'll really like it because it was books that were read to as children and so forth. Pippi Longstocking is coming into your world. A freckle-faced red-haired girl, you wanna know? She'll throw your life into the world.
People on the internet, by the way, had like the most amazing comments for this song. A lot of people feel warm and fuzzy about Pippi Longstocking. So Charlotte thought, okay, we got to discount the Dutch and the Germans. Who are some folks that might not have any feelings towards Sweden or Denmark, who might not even recognize languages? So she enlisted some Chinese participants.
So my next step was to have Chinese people listen to the Danish and the Swedish fragments, because I was pretty sure that they would not be able to recognize the languages. And even Chinese people found Danish much more ugly than Swedish.
Oh no, so does that mean Danish is an ugly language?
I'm afraid that's really my conclusion. Danish is just not such a beautiful language.
Sorry about that, Patrick. So Danish.
Okay, I'll take
it. Confirmed. Danish is an ugly language.
Okay, I totally accept it. But I would also push back and just say perception is just all about association. And so my association with Danish is very different from a lot of other people's.
Sure.
And as a result of that, I don't feel that way, but I get it. I wonder if there has ever been an experiment along these lines, or whether this experiment might have come up with different results, if they'd actually labeled one of these languages a language and the other a dialect.
Right. If Danish was labeled language and Swedish was dialect, how
right.
people would feel.
Would that have made people feel that the one called a language was in some way superior?
Patrick, I don't know if anything would make Danish more beautiful.
Okay. But
that
still
is a very good point. In this case, all of these languages are languages for many political reasons.
That's right. But how did we label language and dialect in the first place? How did those things get labeled?
It's story time.
Ooh, story time. You know what they used to say on BBC during like Children's Hour on the radio? They'd say, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin."
Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
Once upon a time, there was a group of people. Just people. They lived in a valley.
Were they farmers?
Oh, yeah, they were farmers. They were big, big spinach farmers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Made them strong.
Very strong. And they lived their lives, and they grew their spinach, and they raised their children, and they spoke the way they spoke. And every Monday, they set up a market at the crossroads with people from the neighboring valley.
Dairy farmers?
Yes, dairy farmers. So the spinach folks and the dairy folks, they'd get together. And though they spoke slightly differently, they could pretty much understand each other. And all was well and good in the valleys.
It sounds like a very wholesome place.
Very totally. It's really healthy. Then one day, some folks came from a city far away. They heard rumors about this like bounty of spinach and cheese, all organic and unpasteurized.
Uh-oh, I don't like where this is going.
No. It wasn't bad at first. These city folks came. They had a funny way of speaking, but, you know, they figured out how to communicate enough to buy their spinach and their milk and their cheese. And then they went away again, back to the city, feeling pretty content.
I knew this wasn't going to turn out good.
Wait. So the city folk came back for their farm-to-table fare, but this time they brought more city folk, who brought the leaders of the city folk. And the leaders told the farmers, "Hey, we like what you're doing here. We want to help you. So we're going to tax you, spinach and dairy farmers, but in exchange, we'll protect you from the cattle ranchers three valleys away. And we'll also do lots of other stuff, like make schools for your children and teach them about the world. Oh, and we'll teach them our way of speaking. It's sort of like your way of speaking, but better and more official. See here, we can even write it down. We have whole libraries of our speech. What do you have?"
The original concept of language was really a function of literate societies.
This is Lane Green again.
When you call something a language, you tend to see grammars and dictionaries on a shelf, you know, the Berlitz Guide to French. And if there's a literature tradition, we tend to think of it as a language.
This idea that a writing system makes a dialect a real language, it goes back thousands of years, according to Lane.
Already in ancient Rome, you had classical Latin, and you had people writing in Latin, and that gave speakers of Latin, that gave them a sense that this was the real language, and any deviation from, say, the way Cicero wrote was erroneous. And even Cicero himself in that time, this is already 2,000 years ago, was criticizing the quality of Latin around him. So those complaints are ancient. They're literally ancient.
But the thing that cements this idea that written languages are somehow more legitimate comes with the rise of the nation state.
What you get when you get the rise of the nation state is the idea that there's one real variety, standard High German, standard Dutch, standard Flemish, standard French, whatever it is, and that everything else is a deviation from that. When in fact, the standard Dutch and the standard German and the standard French we know today were just dialects that won a race. They happened to be the dialects of certain important people at the point at which the state became the main game in town. The rise of writing, the rise of printing, the rise of governments and so forth gave these randomly chosen dialects the Romance language spoken around Paris, the variety of German that Luther translated the Bible into and so forth. These became our templates for the standard language and gave us this newfangled idea that there's only one real language and a bunch of bad copies of it out there. And those are those dialects.
And the nation state, time and again, has used this perception to denigrate dialects.
When the French Revolution happened, right after the revolution, the revolutionary leaders wanted to take a census of what people spoke around France. What they found was only about a quarter of the population of France was able to use proper French, the written prestigious form spoken in the court and in Paris, and only about 5% of the population, I think, spoke that as their native language. So the whole operation for the next 200 years in France was to use the power of the state to crush out that diversity. As the revolutionaries would put it, they were liberating and giving to the people an opportunity to speak this universal, logical, beautiful, wonderful language called French. So the rise of the nation state is very intimately linked with an explicit desire to make France more homogeneous and to get rid of, as much as possible, a bunch of the diversity of France.
France, of course, is not alone in this. Many nations have used an official language as a tool to knit a country together. Look at Italy or China. Language has also been used as a means to break a country apart.
Good evening. Though nothing is considered safe in the former Yugoslavia, the outdoor market in Sarajevo seemed safe on this sunny morning. Until a shell landed in the midst
of the former
of the
Yugoslavia. Throughout the 90s and into the early aughts, ethnic cleansing and violence ravaged the region as this former communist state broke apart. The U.S. and NATO got involved.
All the ingredients for a major war are there.
Bill Clinton was president.
And in the center of it all, a dictator in Serbia who has done nothing since the Cold War ended but start new wars and pour gasoline on the flames of ethnic and religious division.
And in the midst of the wars on the ground, there was also a war of languages. Serbo-Croatian, the official language spoken in Yugoslavia, broke apart as the country itself broke apart. Each new nation declared its own official language with its own official name.
Okay, my name is Robert Greenberg. I'm a professor of linguistics and a dean at the... No, I'm sorry. I should do that better. I'm not used to doing this. Okay, can I try that one more time?
Sure thing.
My name is Robert Greenberg. I'm a professor of linguistics and dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Auckland in Auckland, New Zealand.
Robert Greenberg studies and speaks. Well, I'm not even going to try.
How would you define it? How should I even call the language?
Well, our traditional new way of calling it, which is the tradition of about 10 years, is Bosnian Croatian Serbian. So BCS, or some people add M for Montenegrin, so some people say BCMS, but most people say still Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian.
Robert first began visiting the region when it was Yugoslavia and not BCS. In 1989, he went to Croatia.
And you could sort of feel trouble in the air.
Robert was staying with some Croatian friends of a friend.
They were very kind, very generous people.
And they were also nationalist, leaning towards the breakup of Yugoslavia and an independent Croatia.
They took me to one of their favorite places, which was the Mirogoj Cemetery in Zagreb, not too far from where they lived. And we stumbled upon the grave of Ludovit Gaj, who was a Yugoslavist in many respects. He was one of the leaders of a more pan-Slavic movement in the 19th century. And my friend, who had been talking all this sort of nationalist Croatian talk about how they need to be independent and all, knelt down very emotionally near the grave and talked about it in moving terms, like this is a person I really admire. This is a person that really wanted the best for us.
So wait a minute. If I've got this right, there's this nationalist friend of his who is a Croatian nationalist. He wants the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Yes.
And he's crying before the grave of a 19th century figure who symbolizes Yugoslavia, who symbolizes the unification of the Balkans. I mean, that makes no sense.
I know. It's totally strange. But to understand just how strange this is, it helps to know a bit more about this 19th century figure, Ludovic Guy, and his influence on the Serbo-Croatian language. And I use that old name purposefully here because Guy is actually responsible, in part, for helping create Serbo-Croatian. Again, here's Robert.
In the 1830s, he was leading essentially the cultural movement. At the time, the Croats were very much under the rule of the Hungarians, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they were trying to Hungarianize the population, you know, make them learn Hungarian as their main language. And so this was first a cultural movement to assert a sense of Croatian identity and language.
So there's this independence movement bubbling up in Croatia. Meanwhile, the nearby Serbs are also living under the rule of both the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. And they're also battling for their language and identity. So the Croats and the Serbs get together.
And they signed an agreement in Vienna in 1850 to create a joint literary language for Serbs and Croats, or joint standard, let's say, in popular terms. But they called it the literary agreement. And that's sort of the what we would call the origin of Serbo-Croatian as a unified language. And it was born out of both these political motivation to join forces against, you know, these stronger empires that were dominating these peoples. So strength in numbers, but also the fact that some of the same dialect was prestigious for both peoples, and therefore it seemed to make sense to these romantic intellectuals at the time that they should join forces. So that sort of was the birth of this thing that had a life until pretty much the breakup of Yugoslavia in 1991.
Wait, so Serbo-Croatian, the language of the former Yugoslavia, it was just a construct itself.
Yes, which was amazing to me when I found this out. It was formed, as Robert explains, by the desire to gain power and assert identity, which is exactly why nearly 150 years later, Serbo-Croatian, Serbian and Croatian were broken apart.
Wow. So the Serbian and the Croatian and these other languages,
Bosnian, too, Montenegrin.
Right. I mean, how close are they all? Is this like Scandinavia? Are they closer or further apart than Danish, Swedish, Norwegian?
Well, as we've learned, mutual intelligibility is a slippery slope. It's hard to measure. But here's how Robert describes it.
Before the breakup, there was a scholar named Kenneth Naylor, and he wrote this article in which he says that Croatian and Serbian, or what was then known as the Western and Eastern variants of a single language called Serbo-Croatian, are not that different from British English and American English. So I think you mostly, and I can mostly understand somebody in Great Britain speaking. I can understand people in New Zealand. Occasionally, of course, I don't, right? Occasionally, there'll be expressions. I had one here where somebody told me they're going to go to the panel beater. And I said, what on earth is that?
Remember, Robert lives in New Zealand.
It's basically the car body shop where they fix your car. So, you know, you just have these different forms. And so there are occasions where I might not understand a whole expression or a whole sentence. What has happened in former Yugoslavia is linguistic intervention or engineering, where you intentionally make your language different. So one of the things that Croatia definitely did when it became independent, it was changing much of its terminology for anything that is administrative politically, like regions are not called by the same name they were called before. Words like passport or identity card, a lot of those sort of administrative bureaucratic terminology changed. And then they adopted some of the older Croatian words. Serbia might have an international word like ekonomika, and Croatia will have their own word, gospodarstvo, or something like that. So they'll use a local word instead of an internationalism. And then sometimes you could have real sentences where you don't understand each other.
Wow. So it really does sound pretty similar to Scandinavia. Right. That they just seem to be dialects of one language.
Or neighboring languages. So I spoke with a Croatian translator. Her name is Ellen Elias Bursac. And according to Ellen, when Croatia was a brand new country, the first Croatian president, Franjo Tuđman, he was responsible for bringing back a lot of words that were used, you know, pre-Serbo-Croatian, but then also for creating new words.
There were funny words like the word for helicopter is helikopter and had been, but under Tuđman, he introduced the word zrakomlat, which means an air beater. And it became this neologism joke. People would refer to zrakomlat people as people who were using too many neologisms, that they themselves, by speaking, were beating the air with their neologisms.
So it was like a big joke. I mean, people, Serbs and Croats, they know they speak similar languages. And so when...
Right, they're not stupid.
She also told me this great story about how when she's a translator, a lot of times people wouldn't write the name of their language. They would just write our language.
If I said to them, okay, well, in English, I can't put our language. You have to come down on one side or another.
Oh, they would literally say our
language.
They would
literally say our language.
And people in Croatia informally would refer to Croatian, and in Serbia they'd refer to Serbian. But people were nervous about saying that in a published text, and they were worried about problems they might have.
She would have to hold people's feet to the fire. So it was a completely tricky and sensitive issue.
Wow. So it's like all of these languages, all of these whatever we want to call them, they got totally weaponized.
Right. In Bosnia, things are so delicate. There's this famous anecdote about a package of cigarettes. Actually, I have a photo of this. On the package, you know, there's the typical warning, smoking kills, that sort of thing. But the warning in Bosnia has to be translated into Bosnian, into Croatian, and into Serbian. And it's virtually the same sentence. So on the package, you see the same sentence three times, smoking kills.
Oh, that's crazy. Especially in that part of the world where everyone smokes anyway. So right. It doesn't matter how many times they're told,
they
kills.
So they're reading it three times, but they still smoke anyway. You know, it's been more than two decades since the wars in the region, but it's still a very, very sensitive issue, even to the point where this past March, a group of linguists from around the region and around the world, they wrote up this quote-unquote declaration of a common language, basically declaring, you know, we are neighboring languages, maybe we are all related. And it just, you know, created a firestorm of criticism from politicians, from people in the region.
But you just couldn't say that. We've just been to war with each other, so we can't possibly claim that we have a common language.
And in fact, even that the name BCS or BCMS, Bosnian, Croatian, Montenegrin, Serbian, notice that it is in alphabetical order. Everything is very, very intentional. And this term I learned, BCS, was a construction that was coined by the International Criminal Court in The Hague during the War Crimes Tribunal because they had to have a way of referring to the language. And Ellen, who we just heard from, she witnessed this firsthand. She worked as a translator with the War Crimes Tribunal for 6 years.
So imagine a courtroom setting where your defendants are from different parts of the former Yugoslavia. The witnesses are from various regions of the former Yugoslavia, and everybody else is speaking English or French. Anything anybody says is being interpreted all the time.
Were there sensitive issues around, you know, the different languages, like when a defendant was Bosnian?
Lots of issues. For example, especially early in the tribunal, many of the defendants were Bosnian Serbs. And a Bosnian Serb, if asked, what language do you speak, would say Serbian, normally. But the fact of the matter is that the way a Bosnian Serb speaks is the way all the people speak in their town. And the Muslims living in that same town would say they speak Bosnian. So when the people selecting interpreters received requests that the interpreter needed to be working into Serbian, they would find somebody working into Serbian, a professional translator into Serbian from Belgrade, and that's a different way of speaking than the way they speak in Bosnia. Plus, the victims who were testifying, the witnesses, were frightened when they heard Serbian spoken because they associated Serbian language with the atrocities they'd experienced. And so people would clam up and they'd stop speaking in the courtroom if they heard Serbian coming over the earphones, interpreting for them what was being said in the courtroom. So it was a delicate situation. what's interesting with all these differences and so much discussion about differences that goes on between Croatian, Bosnian, and Serbian is that there was very, very little debate in the courtroom and protest about not understanding what was being said.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Like in a practical setting like this, even though people were insisting on different, these all being different languages, in the end, whatever you called it, it didn't matter. The words made sense to everyone.
Yeah, everybody understood. And interpretation in the court was pretty smooth, according to Ellen. She said that even the interpreters developed kind of an almost like a neutral hybrid of everything, kind of like what we would call like a mid-Atlantic accent, per se.
Hmm.
Also, the judges discouraged a lot of discussion about languages because they were nervous that this would turn into this thing people would be flogging constantly, you know, saying, oh, you know, I can't understand this because of this or whatever. In the very few instances, I think there was one famous one where one of the defendants really tried to use, I didn't understand what was said because it wasn't in my version of the language.
She's talking about Serbian politician Vojislav Šešelj here, notoriously provocative during his more than 11 years on trial in The Hague.
The judge said, I'm sorry, I understand that, in fact, somebody who grew up as you did during Yugoslavia, where the language was Serbo-Croatian and it was shared, you were exposed to all these things and you do know these things and you do understand them, and we're not going to tolerate these discussions. There were 10,000 sessions of court, not days, but sessions, 2-3 hour sessions of court in the 20 years of the work of the tribunal. And there are virtually, except for that one defendant, Vojislav Šešelj, there's very few instances of defendants complaining about language and not understanding things. And he famously said, well, I'm sorry, I don't understand this word točno, which is the word for accurately or precisely. And the word that he would use would be tachno, which is just the difference between an O and an A. And he was making fun. He was being
accurate.
Exactly. He was trying to use it to be kind of a buffoon.
A buffoon and a nationalist, just making a point to point out that his mother tongue was a separate language. Šešelj, by the way, was acquitted last year. His acquittal is now under appeal.
Okay, so have we worked this out? Do we know now when red becomes orange?
Oh, take it away, Lane.
People want a clear-cut answer to what's a language, what's a dialect. But anybody who's kind of deep in this subject will tell you, look, there's a lot of subjectivity here. And what we're really talking about most of the time is political.
Patrick, when you call it orange, it's orange.
Oh, it's like the old I know it when I see it thing, right? Except it's not.
Except it's not.
It sounds like, I mean, why not just get rid of these terms?
Well, there is a good word that linguists use.
People just tend to use the word variety. Variety avoids the whole question entirely. Variety can be an accent. A variety can be sort of semi-dialect. A variety can be a full-on dialect. Variety kind of avoids you having to make that choice.
It's vague, bland, it kind of covers every eventuality. I guess that's okay. But it would also seem that some linguists might have a problem with it just because of its vagueness. What does it exactly describe?
Yeah, it's just everything. Although we could just call everything a dialect. But I think
it's
people would
so
get
diplomatic.
I know. But when it comes down to it, I don't know that there's a good answer. And that's where we end today.
Language is politics.
Language is politics. And we didn't even bring up the one cliche this whole entire time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Let's just
leave it at that.
Leave it at that.
Thanks this week to so many people, to Kathy Merritt, to Andrew Sussman, to Jonathan Dyer, one of our most faithful listeners, to Tina Toby, to Mike Wilkins. Thanks to all the people out there speaking all those beautiful varieties and ugly varieties.
Okay, all right. I know who you're talking about there. Thanks also to you, dear listeners. Please leave us a review, if you can, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, whatever variety of podcatcher you choose.
You can hit us up at Lingopod. I'm at Porzuki, P-O-R-Z-U-C-K-I.
And I'm at Patricox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X.
Thanks so much for listening.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities.